Welcome to VOA's International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Coming up, our correspondent joins us with big news from the race for the White House, reaction to the Sino-U.S. conference in Beijing. An analyst talks about the importance of the Indian Prime Minister's visit to Washington, and a documentary giving unique insight into the life of humanitarian and boxing great Muhammad Ali.
Testimonials of friends and adversaries paint the Olympian and three-time boxing champion as a sensitive, poignant, and courageous man.
It's all on today's International Edition. Former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is making history as the first woman to be the presumed nominee for president of one of the country's two major political parties. Joining us here in the studio with the tales is senior national correspondent Jim Malone. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Susan.
I went to bed last night, and Clinton looked like she probably would get the Democratic nomination after today's primaries. I woke up today, and news services said she had it locked up. How did all that happen while I was sleeping?
The Associated Press has been tracking very carefully the delegate commitments. And remember, we select them not only through the primaries and caucuses based on those results, but in the Democratic Party, there are about 700 or so superdelegates. These are elected officials, party activists, people who are very active in the party. And they have been flocking to Clinton for several months. She's got around 500 of those commitments. Bernie Sanders has only a handful, relatively speaking. So by the time the Associated Press checked in with more of these superdelegates, they had found that Clinton had gotten to the magic number she needed to get to. And this was even before, as you note, the six states voting today.
But she's not really saying that she's the winner yet, right?
No, she's going to wait for the results to come in, especially, say, from New Jersey, where I think she'll be favored. The big prize is California. It's a tight race there. But even if Bernie Sanders pulls off a win there, they're still going to divvy up the delegates basically almost 50-50, assuming it's a close race. And so she's just going to keep adding to her lead. And there's no real way at this point for Sanders to overtake her. Sanders' argument is he does better in the polls against Trump than she does. And he's trying to get super delegates to come to him away from her. It's not been working.
Well, what does this promotion for Hillary Clinton mean for the Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders? So where does he stand now?
Well, that's going to be a lot of pressure, I think, beginning Wednesday. Once we get the results in from this last big day of the primaries, particularly if Clinton is able to win in California as well as New Jersey, I think that's going to put a lot of pressure on him to kind of back down. But, you know, he's got very fervent supporters, and I think the Clintons want to be very careful how they handle this situation, because she will very much need those people to come out and be with her in November. And she's probably going to need Bernie Sanders to be out there campaigning for her as well. So I think we're entering a very delicate phase now where Sanders may be looking at winding down his campaign. But how that is done is going to be significant.
They don't want him hurting her image when she faces Trump.
No, and she's very eager to look ahead to Donald Trump. She wants to get this Democratic primary behind her. It was much tougher than anyone predicted. And the Sanders people are much more committed, I think, than the Clinton people figured they would be. So now it's a time to try to pull the party together. And, you know, today is 8 years to the day when Hillary Clinton ended her first campaign for the White House against Barack Obama and then wind up endorsing him. So it's really come full circle now for Hillary Clinton.
Well, over in the Republican camp, a presumed nominee, Donald Trump, has gotten in trouble again because of some remarks about a judge in a case against Trump University. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this is an extraordinary situation. Just earlier today, Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, said that Trump's comments about this judge were, in his words, the textbook definition of racism. Trump, you may recall, called out this judge saying he was making rulings against him in a case involving Trump University plaintiffs who were arguing they were defrauded of money. And Trump has said that because of the judge's ethnicity, he's of Mexican heritage, he can't fairly adjudicate the case, even though he's got no evidence to present in any way. These statements have drawn widespread condemnation, not just from Democrats, but from fellow Republicans, although it puts Republicans in a weird position. Ryan says basically the statement is racist. He wants Trump to take it away. but he's not going to withdraw his own endorsement of Trump, saying, you know, the alternative is not Hillary Clinton either. But Republicans are having a bad week. Trump is having a bad week. And as we've seen for Clinton, it's a good week. So I think we're going to get a lot of these between now and November. One person will be up one week, the other person the next week.
It makes it also interesting.
It does.
Okay. Thank you, Jim.
Sure.
And with what's going on the web today concerning this story, joining us is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you for having me, as always.
Well, what are they saying out there about the U.S. political developments?
Well, it is a big primary day here in the U.S., but all eyes are on California, the biggest of the six states voting today. And depending on who you ask on social media, it's either a huge day or kind of a not-so-big day. A few people tweeting out saying, oh, it's kind of an anti-climax because, of course, the Associated Press and other news organizations came out and said that Hillary Clinton will be the presumptive nominee. So they're saying, oh, well, don't really need to go out and vote. It's already kind of been decided. But both sides are also on social media saying, no, it's the exact opposite. You need to get out and vote. For Hillary Clinton's people, they're saying, well, nothing's certain yet. We need to make sure that we run up high numbers in these primaries and get a lot of delegates so we can kind of cushion that lead. Bernie Sanders supporters are saying, it's not over yet. We need to go out there. And just because they declared Hillary Clinton the presumptive nominee doesn't mean she's the nominee. A lot of them are pointing out that the superdelegates don't vote until July 25th. So there's a lot of back and forth, a lot of get out the vote. It's kind of this last push. These are the last few states that are going to vote in the primary process, in the presidential primaries. So we're seeing a lot of excitement on social media and a lot of get out the vote effort. There was one tweet that I liked very much. The gentleman said, the last time I saw people this angry over simple math, I was being told I needed a math tutor to pass sixth grade. So there's a lot of kind of politicking as far as the superdelegates, the math of all these primaries.
And there's something today that's kind of bittersweet, and that's the death of Prince, and now he's being remembered in a day.
Yes. Well, we, you know, broke two big Prince stories here on International Edition. We talked about right when Prince died, we broke that news, and we broke the news of his death and how he died, the opioid overdose. Well, now today is hashtag Prince Day, where the governor of Minnesota, where Prince lived, and he was very big proponent of his state of Minnesota. The governor there has declared today Prince Day because it would have been Prince's 58th birthday. So we're seeing a lot of tributes on social media. We saw kind of right after Prince died, the tributes on social media, then with his death announcement of his reason of his death, we saw a lot of sadness, and now it's back to kind of the happy memories of Prince. So lots of photos, videos, moments being shared by his fans today.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Andrew, for stopping by.
Thank you.
Among the top stories in the world, a car bomb targeting a police bus in Istanbul kills 11 people and wounds 36. Experts watch to see if the Indian prime minister commits to ratifying the Paris Climate Agreement. The UN Refugee Agency says tens of thousands of people in Niger have been forced to flee their homes in the wake of Boko Haram attacks. News, feature reports, and more are at voanews.com. VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Italian astronomers say they have observed something never seen before, a fast-spinning pulsar in the nearby Andromeda, or M31, galaxy. Their findings were published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. Pulsars are spinning neutron stars that produce a focused beam of magnetic radiation, which some say resembles a lighthouse beacon. Since pulsars rotate, their light can appear to be pulsating. Neutron stars are the compacted remains of an enormous star that exploded in a supernova. While pulsars and other rotating neutron stars are quite common in our own Milky Way, this marks the first time such an object has been spotted in the Andromeda Galaxy. The astronomers made their discovery as they were reviewing past data from the European Space Agency's XMM Newton Space Telescope. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The 8th Annual U.S.-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue has wrapped up in Beijing. Afterward, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with members of the news media, and among them was our own correspondent, Nike Ching, who joins us now on the line from the Chinese capital. Welcome, Nike.
Hi, Susan.
What did the U.S. Secretary of State have to say about the talks?
He said both countries had in-depth discussions on issues, and both are looking at the big picture. But he also acknowledged there remains difference and disagreement. New development includes the talks on a new and controversial law which regulates foreign non-governmental organizations. Kerry said he got assurance from Chinese leaders the application of the new non-governmental organization law will not interfere on the activities of foreign NGOs, and he is confident the new law will be carried out in good spirit. Regarding the difference, officials said the South China Sea was heartily discussed during the talks. Kerry insisted no country to move unilaterally, and there's a need for peaceful resolution through rule of law and negotiation.
What was the Chinese response to the meetings?
Like Kerry, Chinese side emphasized the need to talk over disagreement. Chinese President Xi Jinping said China-U.S. relationship is highly complicated, and both have more common interests than difference. Of course, Chinese did not back down from positions over the South China Sea, saying historically China owns most of the waters and differences between claimants should be negotiated bilaterally and directly, not through international tribunal or the third party. Regarding NGO law, Chinese State Councilor Yang Jiechi said, as long as foreign governments and foreign non-governmental organizations abide by Chinese law, they will not face hurdles.
Was there anything said about the future of relations between the two nations?
Yes, both are emphasized there's more need for continuing talk, and then said that the strategic and economic dialogue really paved the way for the G20 summit this fall, which the G20 summit will be held in Beijing. Kerry said there will be some disagreements, but managing the difference, maximizing the opportunities, and through ongoing talks. He said that 120 outcomes were reached this year under the strategic talk. And then from the outcomes issued by the State Department, that includes regional security implementation of climate change, global health security, and global nuclear security. And on the Chinese side, interestingly, without mentioning the name of Donald Trump, Chinese President Xi Jinping said this year both countries will have important domestic political agenda, but he said that he hoped both will continue to work toward a new model of major country relationship. Susan?
Thank you, Nike, for speaking with us today from Beijing.
You're welcome.
Coming up on International Edition, the Indian Prime Minister comes to Washington, and audio tapes give a special peek into the life of the greatest. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi met with President Obama at the White House today and addresses a joint meeting of Congress Wednesday as the world's two largest democracies strengthen economic and security ties. Under agreement reached in April, the two militaries can use each other's bases for replenishment and repair. They are also in talks to co-produce advanced military hardware and have released a joint strategic vision ensuring freedom of navigation, including in the South China Sea, where China is in a tense standoff with the U.S. and other countries over maritime claims. For its part, New Delhi is seeking greater U.S. investment, including a long-pending deal to allow Toshiba's Westinghouse Electric to build nuclear reactors in India. On climate change, India has committed to increasing its share of electricity generation from non-fossil fuels by 40% by the year 2030. RAND Corporation's South Asia analyst Rafiq Dosani tells VOA's Victor Beatty, inviting Mr. Modi to speak on Capitol Hill underscores the importance of the bilateral relationship.
It signals, I think, quite clearly not just that the House of Congress views the India relationship as important, but somewhat rarely that both the president, the administration, and the House of Congress are united on this particular aspect, that the India relationship is one of the, probably the defining relationships between any two countries for the 21st century. So in that sense, this is a very important, this joint signal.
One report suggests that they hope to increase trade from the current $120 billion a year to some half a trillion dollars.
Trade is growing very fast. I think from an administration point of view, they would like much more. They see a couple of areas where India could do more. One is in defense purchases, where India has been tended to use a number of suppliers, not just the United States, but also other countries, including historical suppliers like the Soviet Union. But in private sector trade, as well as in foreign direct investment, there's tremendous growth. This reflects both the low base from which it is starting, but also improvements in India's capacity to accept foreign direct investment. Still a long way to go. I mean, in terms of infrastructure and the rules on corruption, India is well behind most countries in Southeast Asia, including China, but also countries like Vietnam.
New Delhi remains wary of outright alliances with the U.S. and other major powers. According to the Wall Street Journal, in a recent interview, Mr. Modi said he wouldn't deviate from the non-alignment doctrine that has defined India's international relations for decades.
Yes, India has very little to gain from an alliance with the United States. The countries that have done so have done so largely for security reasons, not economic reasons. And in this multipolar world, where India hopes to become one of the poles, it sees little need to rely on an existing pole. And it knows that the U.S. needs it from a security aspect with regard to China, as much as India needs the U.S. to be a reliable supplier of weaponry, and within that context to open doors for good relations in the rest of the industrialized world. So it's a two-way relationship where India recognizes it doesn't need an alliance. I think the U.S. would be very happy to have one with India. But from an Indian point of view, it just increases a dependency that it doesn't need.
Rafiq Dosani of the RAND Corporation. India also is seeking global support to become a member of the 48-nation Nuclear Suppliers Group, which aims to govern the global trade in nuclear-related materials and prevent civilian nuclear programs from diverting materials for military use. Membership would help New Delhi access nuclear fuel and technology. But it is not yet signed on to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. This is VOA.
Green Beat, for a healthier planet.
Here's a do-it-yourself project that could help you make a few dollars and save the environment at the same time. Too good to be true? Dave Hawkins doesn't think so.
With this project, we want to try and boost plastic recycling by providing people the tools to get started. So this is all the basic information people need to start their own little recycle business.
Hawkins is the founder of Precious Plastic, and he's figured out a way for anyone to recycle plastic in their home, then create some interesting, possibly sellable items like toys, clipboards, pots, and bowls. Hawkins says he's on a mission to help the world recycle.
By visiting our website, you can simply spread it around. Make sure it reaches your friends, uncle, neighbor, but also that farmer living somewhere in the middle of Africa. Once the information is spread, the recycling begins.
A study by the National Resources Defense Council says more than 1 million jobs could be created just in the United States by recycling 75% of its waste. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
With Muhammad Ali's passing, the world is remembering a man who transcended sports, culture, and religion to become a global icon. I Am Ali, a 2014 documentary by Claire Lewis, used audio tapes he recorded with family and friends to paint an intimate portrait of the boxing legend. VOA's Penelope Ballou has details in this report for VOA Television.
My father has a lot of sides, and you hear about the fights. You don't hear about family that much and what that meant to him.
What's your dad's name?
Muhammad Ali.
No one, not even some members of his family, knew of the existence of these audio tapes until recently.
Ma'am? You're now 11 years old.
They thread the narrative of the boxing champion's life in Claire Lewis's documentary. Ali's daughter, Hannah, offered the tapes to Lewis.
Say, I love my dad.
I love my daddy. I love my poo-poo-head daddy.
Okay.
My father was always conscious about history. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why he made this series of audio tape cassette recordings.
Say, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
The film shows the whole world in love with him. Testimonials of friends and adversaries paint the Olympian and three-time boxing champion as a sensitive, poignant, and courageous man. Because he refused to serve in the Vietnam War, he was stripped of his championship title, and his boxing license was revoked. His close friend, former football player Jim Brown, remembers.
He had a lot of courage.
the risk he had to take, and then to be isolated, to have his crown taken away, not be able to make a living. That was difficult.
But he stuck to his convictions, and in 1974, at the age of 32, Ali made a comeback.
When George Foreman meets me, he'll pay his debt. I can drown a drink of water and kill a dead tree. Wait till you see Muhammad Ali.
He defeated formidable George Foreman and recaptured his title.
I get into the ring with the guy. I bluffed him. I done everything. Beat him up basically for about 5 or 6 rounds. I thought it was easy. Then about the 6th round, he whispered in my ear after I'd hit him in the side, "That all you got, George?" And that was about all I had.
I Am Ali does not say much about his broken marriages, but it highlights his bond with his children.
I was the Concord of boxing. I was at a high altitude than the rest.
As Ali has aged, we hear him begin to slur his words, a sign of developing Parkinson's disease. He finally retired in the late 1970s, and in the mid-80s, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. But to the world and his children, he remains an icon of power and grace.
If anyone wonder why me, Muhammad Ali, is making these tapes, is because history is so beautiful.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab and look for International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations Committee on Non-Governmental Organizations recently took a step that can only be seen as an insult to one of the UN's key founding documents, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in particular, Article 19, which enshrines the right to freedom of opinion and expression. The NGO committee voted to deny the Committee to Protect Journalists, a prominent press freedom organization dedicated to defending the right of journalists to report the news without fear of reprisal, consultative status at the UN. Such status would have allowed CPJ to participate in certain UN meetings and conferences, including at the Human Rights Council in Geneva. The vote was 6 in favor of granting CPJ accreditation, 10 against, and 3 abstentions. Countries voting in favor include Mauritania, Greece, Uruguay, and Guinea. Countries voting against included Russia, China, Sudan, Pakistan, and Venezuela. The United States strongly supported CPJ's bid for accreditation. Before the vote, U.S. Representative for Economic and Social Affairs Sarah Mendelson pointed to the importance of the role of civil society organizations in providing an independent voice on matters of public policy and applauded the healthy critique offered by the CPJ to nations around the world, including the United States. After the vote, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power called the denial of CPJ's accreditation deeply disappointing and said that the rejection of CPJ accreditation is part of a larger pattern, noting that CPJ's request for consultative status had been repeatedly deferred since the organization first applied in 2012. It is increasingly clear that the NGO committee acts more and more like an anti-NGO committee, Ambassador Power said, adding that the United States will bring the matter up again for a vote before the full 54-member Economic and Social Council when it meets in July. Countries have to decide what side they're on, said Ambassador Power. Are they on the side of free expression and organizations to try to advance that cause? Or are they hostile to Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? And I think if you look at the list of countries who voted no, one learns a few things.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.